Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is arts and cultural heritage producer Jeff Carmack. And Sauk Center, Minnesota can boast being the hometown of one of America's most prominent authors, Nobel Prize winner Sinclair Lewis. Well, 80 years ago, he wrote a book called It Can't Happen Here. The story's protagonist is a newspaper editor by the name of Doremus Jessup. And we're told the story of how a charismatic populist politician by the name of Buzz Windrip comes to power by promising to return the country to prosperity and greatness. In 1936, the novel was adapted into a play by Lewis and co-writer John Moffat, and is meant to be a mirror of the rise of fascism in Europe during this time period. And the play was then premiered 2 weeks before the presidential election around the country. 80 years later, It Can't Happen Here has been re-released by the Berkeley Repertory Theater and offered up to any institution that would care to produce it in whatever way they could. Also, in a coordinated effort nationwide, 2 weeks before the election, St. Cloud State University was a part of this project, and in today's Untold Story of Central Minnesota, we're looking at the cyclical nature of humanity and how this book from 80 years ago is still extremely relevant today. The entire performance is recorded and up on our website at kvsc.org under the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota podcast link. But for those who aren't familiar with the history of It Can't Happen Here, today's episode might be an uncomfortable reminder about just how predictable and easy to manipulate humans really can be. As we begin behaving on our deepest archetypical level, which is what the characters in Lewis's work end up becoming. So we're going to start off with a brief history of Sinclair Lewis and how It Can't Happen Here came into being, with the introduction to the play at St. Cloud State by Dave Simpkins, publisher of the Sauk Center Herald and Sinclair Lewis Historian.
He spent 2 weeks with his brother over here, and he in details smoking a lot of cigarettes. he went swimming in the quarries. He rode his bicycle out to St. Joseph and watched the parade on the 4th of July, and he played a lot of tennis with the girls on campus. As many of you might know, Lewis was born in 1885 in Sauk Center, Minnesota. He graduated from high school in 1902, and then he went on to Oberlin Academy, where he was his prep school for college. Then he went to Yale, graduated in 1908, as I mentioned. And all these years, he was just an exuberant, enthusiastic, hungry student for knowledge. And we bummed around for a couple years, ended up in New York City and started writing some books. He got a big piece of luck when he started writing for the Saturday Evening Post. And his first article, he made $1,000 in 1915. I'd like to get $1,000 for an article today. And that just led him into a progression into the 1920s. 1920 Main Street hit. It was the hottest book of that era. He wrote four more books in the 1920s, Arrowsmith, Dodsworth, Babbitt, and Elmer Gantry. And they were the best-selling books of the era. He was the number one seller in the 1920s. And then in 1930, of course, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. First American to do that. Very compelling. And then after that Nobel, he kind of wandered around for a while. All his life, he had an interest in Germany. He studied German by a teacher at school named Gunderson, taught him German. And they used to go bike riding around Sauk Center, go on picnics, the whole class, and speak German. And he had a German pen pile. He considered going to college in Germany. He had a fascination with Germany. And then in 1926, he married Dorothy Thompson, who is one of America's leading foreign correspondents. And she was a European correspondent, the first Western journalist to interview Adolf Hitler. And she was the first Western journalist to be jackbooted out of Hitler's Nazi Germany. So she knew what Nazi and fascism was about. And so they came back to the United States. She briefed with Winston Churchill, she briefed with Franklin Roosevelt, and she said, be careful. This Nazi, this fascism thing is a movement that is dangerous to the very essence of America. It can't happen here. And that just lit up a little flame in Lewis and kind of brought back his whole creative energies. And as you will discover tonight, you know, and that way that he could just, brilliant way of packing a lot of information and a lot of description and words. It was this compelling story that is just as vital today as it was in 1935, 1936. So looking forward to this. Thank you.
And that was Dave Simpkins from the Sauk Center Herald, as he gave a little history to the audience before the play at St. Cloud State University of It Can't Happen Here. The reading of this performance was part of a coordinated effort by the Berklee Repertory Theater. And next we're going to talk with the person who is critical in coordinating this from Berklee, Sarah MacArthur.
Well, I'm the project coordinator. I'm a freelancer with Berklee Rep. I started with them last year. I actually was on the board many years ago. And then last year I did a big project with them for the Anna Deavere Smith project that they were doing, Notes from the Field. And so this came up with Susie Medak, and she called me and asked if I wanted to come back and coordinate this nationwide reading. And I said, yeah, absolutely. It came about because last February they were looking for a play to do, and Tony Ticcone and his associate director, Lisa, we're putting ideas around. And this idea of doing the Sinclair Lewis, It Can't Happen Here, kept coming back up for them. But the play that had been written back in 36 was very outdated and would need to be rewritten. So they decided to do that and actually just put pedal to the metal and get it rewritten. They put it into workshop this summer and put it on stage in September. Very fast turnaround project because it was so important to them to get this going. And over the summer, Susie Medak, who is the managing director at Berklee Rep, was contacted by Harvey Weinstein. Harvey had been contacted by a man named Rajan Cohen. And Rajan and Harvey were talking about this project as being something that was so important to get out into the world. And Harvey was too busy to deal with it at that time. He didn't have the bandwidth. So he put Rajan in direct contact with Susie Medak. And they started working on it, and Tony, of course, was fully behind it. The motivation, the impulse behind the national focus was that this was an initial part of the It Can't Happen Here's storyline in terms of its own existence. Sinclair Lewis wrote the book, and then the Federal Theater Project saw it as an opportunity to get that message out in a play, and the Federal Theater Project actually asked Sinclair Lewis to adapt it and create the play for them and get it out around the country as fast as possible in 1936. So they premiered it simultaneously in 21 theaters in 17 states at that time in 1936. There was a passion and a need to get the message out the title, it says it all, that juxtaposition where it says it can't happen here when they were trying to say it could. And this needs to be stopped because at the time, the climate in the country was very similar to what it is right now, economically and immigration-wise and wars in other countries and just all this unrest we're feeling now was being felt at that time. And so the Federal Theater Project wanted to push this forward. So Berklee Rep and Rajan Cohen really wanted to encourage this to get out and for everybody to be able to have an opportunity to do a reading if they wanted to and reach as many people as possible because it is equally important today as it was back then to realize that this kind of thing can happen here. And so Susie took this on, said, yes, let's make it happen. And Rajan Cohen was the major funder for getting this project going. Susie wanted to reach a lot of people. Her hope had been to have it be widely read, but it took quite a while for the estate to grant its approval to have the readings done, just by virtue of any number of things that were going on for them as well. And so it took them longer. So we only got this rolling the beginning of September, and we had until the last week of October to be doing the readings. So it took about 8 weeks from the beginning of really actually getting out the invitations for people to get involved to when we actually were doing the readings across the country.
And how many different organizations did you end up having participate in this?
We had 50 participants in 24 states, which is pretty awesome, I think. There were 20 theaters, 12 universities, 12 libraries, high school, a coffee shop, and 4 in-home readings.
And what kind of feedback have you gotten back from folks who have done this?
Oh, it's been amazing feedback. You know, my general comment about the feedback is how much it has impacted people that they could do something. I mean, I know that as an organizer of the project itself, that's how I felt. I thought, oh my gosh, I can do something. I can help organize this project and get people talking about this. And I think every person who did a reading had that same feeling of this is more than just sending in my, you know, donation to a candidate. This is actually getting people to think. And I think that's how every person who was doing a reading approached it. You know, we got comments like, you know, the parallels are chilling. One person sent out a comment that said, we political types can just do so much. We need our artists to help, all of them now. And I thought that was a really great comment on the understanding that when you see this being read, you feel it in a different way than when it's just a political article about whatever is currently going on. You see the magnitude. Every house was probably, you know, in the audience was between 50 and 150 people because these were small venues for the most part. Some of them were libraries. All libraries who did it were saying that this was one of the best projects that they ever put together. It just felt so meaningful to them. One in-home group titled their experience an afternoon of active artistic venting, which I thought was funny. They had five people in their group that were over 80 years old. Afterwards, they had a conversation about, you know, how these things keep coming up in this country. It was very moving to have that age range. Another comment from a group that saw our reading down in Topanga, California, commented that she was so moved because there were so many young people there. There were people who were just coming to this political arena without having the perspective that the older folks in the room did. And to have that community feel was very powerful for her. We've had several universities who said that their cross-pollination of students and faculty reading the play together, doing the reading as actors, one group actually had teachers from multiple disciplines, different departments of the university, as well as acting as theater students, performing all together. And then they performed it for other people. And they all found that collaboration, that crossing the divides between departments and ages to be really powerful. And this play speaks to that.
Nice. Yep. That's exactly what happened at St. Cloud State. We had all sorts of folks participating. We had all different disciplines, you know, students, faculty. We've got, Sinclair Lewis is from this area. His brother was a doctor here on campus, and Lewis would come into town every once in a while and just kind of hang out. St. Cloud State actually has the second largest collection of Sinclair Lewis stuff in our archives, mm-hmm. and we even had our SCSU the archivist. He was in the play too. Yeah, it was a very, very interesting experience.
Well, I did want to share one of our groups was down in Louisiana, and you were talking about getting people in trouble, and she was concerned that the content of the reading might get her in trouble. I mean, this little library in Louisiana, and she said that what happened was really important to them. That to create, you know, this environment where they were able to present something that was so thought-provoking at this very time, in this very location for them, in this political season that we're in right now, just felt so meaningful to them. And like they could really actually shift things. They could actually make a statement. So it's very exciting.
It is. It is one of those chances to actually do something. If there is a place that people would like to get more information just on this play, on this project, how would they go about looking that up?
Well, Berkeley Rep's website is probably the best place, berkeleyrep.org. And, you just look at all the shows, and the show that they want to click on would be It Can't Happen Here. And then under that tab, there's a section that shows the nationwide reading and shows all the places that the readings were done. It also, there is also their program for the stage production that they did is in there. And that's got lots of articles in it that are very interesting. So I would go back to Berkeley Rep's website and take a look there.
Excellent. Well, thanks for chatting with me today.
You bet. Take care.
You're in tune to 88.1 FM at KVSC and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. Today we're talking about how St. Cloud State University was a part of a nationwide performance of Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, 80 years after its initial coordinated nationwide premiere, 2 weeks before the 1936 election. And now we're going to talk with the person who got it together here at St. Cloud State, from the Department of Theater and Film Studies, Carol Cooley.
Well, it was a very powerful experience. It Can't Happen Here. Not only because I wasn't familiar with the work before going in, you know, we had the rehearsal and everything. I'm like, this is pretty incredible. But then also, I think the crowd responded too.
Yes, very much so.
Very much so.
Standing ovation.
I know.
That was impressive.
Yeah, a standing ovation for just a sitting and reading.
Yes.
Yeah, I heard from a lot of people that people kind of teared up. There were gasps at times where I expected them to be, especially with some of the things that were said by some of the first, I don't know, like third of the play is, kind of before the election.
Right.
And there were definitely things that were said that people gasped in the audience because we have heard these things within what is going on now.
Well, and the playwrights were very conscious of that. I mean, in reading the background material, the version of the play that was initially performed just didn't age well. And so they really went at looking and going back to the novel as well and really looking at the arc of the action in the novel, and then contemporizing some of the language. It was in one of the letters that they sent out, one of the pages that came, I think, with the script. Mm-hmm. But they were very conscious that they wanted to maintain, to sound as much like Sinclair Lewis as possible.
Yeah.
Which I think they did.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. Honestly, I was really pleased when I read the script because I was expecting an agitprop, you know, I'm going to beat you over the head now with ideas.
Yeah.
And not really have characters, just have ideas there. And that's hard for an audience to sit through. We're not used to that. Well, we're used to it in political speak, but we're not used
like
to it.
It is like lecturing.
Yes.
You're getting lectured from characters, and that's not quite what you're there for.
Exactly. That part was really exciting. I think, too, they kept that voice of the 30s. And we heard it, I think, through there, that it helped us make these parallels.
Yeah, that's the complicated thing about this piece. You know, yeah, we are modern. We've got all these different institutions in place, but
how little things have changed.
Yeah, and that's what it comes back to. Yeah. You see these things like, oh my gosh, this is what happens. And it's little things we take for granted because they're just part of our everyday thing.
Right. And it made me think, too, because of the work that I did with The Absolute at Large, which is early piece from the 20s. And similarly, it's like what goes around comes around kind of stuff. So because I felt it was so important for people to think about it now. And that's where I'm incredibly pleased to have been part of this nationwide reading. And we were the first in Minnesota. I mean, it really came out because I did recognize the title. I was reading, there's a theater forum on the interwebs called Howl Round, and I highly recommend it for theater folk. It tackles a lot of the issues that everybody's facing and also brings to light potentially either performances or I would even say movements, you know, it's like how things are going in different aspects of theater. Jack Rule, who's with Mixed Blood, did an excellent, I guess, blog about how to be an artistic director in a theater, you know. And so it's like I go to it every now and then. And I realized I hadn't been reading it because I'd been really busy. And so I sat down, this is what, a couple of weeks back, maybe three, and opened it up and went, it can happen here. And it rang a bell. From my theater history class when I was an undergrad, was like, isn't there a play, It Can't Happen Here? And so I read, and it was just like, oh, this is amazing. Berkeley Rep is doing this. And I read deeper, and I got to the end, and they're like, they're offering a nationwide reading. We can participate. And I felt like, how did we not know this? And why aren't we doing it? Well, okay, we will do it. You know, as soon as I got permission from Berkeley Rep, and they included us, I was just like, yes, let's go. And I'm so pleased with the volunteers that were in the cast and their commitment and dedication to, in essence, bring this to life.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked because I wasn't very familiar with it. And he asked me to do it. I'm like, oh, sure, I'll show up, read a couple of things. And then actually looked at the script and looked at the list of characters. I'm like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I show up and it's like, yeah, we had, what, 15
yes.
people on stage? Yeah. And, you know, to pull this off, everybody had multiple roles. And...
And even actually when you read the script, there are more roles in there than they outline when you first go, like, okay.
Yep. Every once in a while we ran into that. It's like, well, we need a voice here. Who yep. hasn't said something in a while? And yeah. Well, but that's the nature of it. You've got this, you know, kind of come back to, you know, what is actually happening today. You've got all these different players involved. Maybe, you know, a couple of primary ones, but there's all these different things happening mm-hmm. and it's easy to get swept up and not be able to look at the whole thing objectively. And just because you're swept up, you're concentrating on one particular candidate or, you know, one particular issue, or you're getting wrapped up in work and or you're just sick of it. And, mm-hmm. you know, all that kind of thing. So you don't really pay attention anymore. You're just, I want it to be over. And then the strangest things can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that, I think, is kind of what is really at the heart of the play, is if we don't pay attention, if we make uneducated choices, then we're going to wind up with a big problem.
Yes.
And what was it? Ben Franklin said, well, you've got yourself a republic. Good luck keeping it.
Yeah. Yes.
That's kind of...
And I think over time, I think it has to do partially with our idea about American, like, individualism, and that everybody's right. Everybody's got an opinion and it's valid and all that good stuff. I think it's led people to transfer their responsibilities as a citizen off onto something else and not take that important responsibility to heart, that we're all in this together. And I think it's complex. Mm-hmm. I think it comes from many, many different angles at the same time. It's easier to buy into somebody telling you something, and we're such good consumers.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes.
And so if you're listening to your regular place of consumption, you're not questioning it. Even to the point where, I mean, social media is great. However, if you are only exposed to what the algorithms bring you, how do you make informed choices?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Everybody thinks they've got an objective
yes.
view. And that's the trick, is nobody has an objective view. One of the most difficult things in journalism is to be objective.
Oh, yes.
I mean, there's always a little bit of subjectivity in there, almost always. I mean, maybe if you're reporting the weather, you know, but yet you're reporting the weather where you are. I don't know.
And I think that it plays into the character of Jessup, the editor of the newspaper, and... Mm. His conflict, because I think he really is trying to be authentic. He's trying to be a good journalist, and he gets caught up, and he basically has to be a hack to yeah. survive.
Yeah, well, he gets demoted, basically, yeah. in order to survive, and then eventually more than loses his job. He's yeah. thrown into a camp, and it comes back to the name of the play. Oh, that can't happen here.
Mm-hmm. Clever title.
Very clever title, because there are so many things where it's a series of small steps.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, every once in a while there's a larger step, but then these steps keep happening and it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And we do see that in our world.
If oh, yeah.
There aren't the huge steps, but there are small steps.
Well, I'm thinking about Standing Rock right now.
Yeah.
And how our media, a very small part of it, is paying a small amount of attention to it. And this is a huge story.
Yeah, it's a huge story in that, you know, there's a lot of people up there protesting. There's a lot of different police departments up there
yes.
assisting, including the Hennepin County Sheriff's
yes.
Department. And
why? Come on. Why are they there?
Yeah.
These are people on their own land.
Yeah, and this is that brings up a point. There was a system in place for a particular sheriff's department to call out for help for something, and then mm-hmm. other ones, you know, and you would think, oh, that makes sense if they've got some kind of crisis. But this is a protest.
It is.
This is a peaceful protest. So why did that system kick in?
Right.
And, you know, who's in charge of that kind of thing? And it's those kind of things where you think, well, wait, is that a big step or a little step? And, you know, with you know, going back to the play, mm-hmm. you know, these little things happen, like in our world, where we don't hear about it or it doesn't affect us directly. Yep. Well, it affects them.
But in a sense, this, I mean, it does affect us. It's going to affect the quality of our water, of our lives. The aquifer is ginormous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And if that's being poisoned.
Yeah, that's our future.
Yes.
Those are the kind of things, you know, you take the, it can't happen here, and you try to, what is happening here? You know, maybe that's another way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. What are the parallels?
And I think Lewis is asking that question. I really do. Through the novel, through the play, through these stories. Another part of this that really struck me is that the work that we did last year with Art is Free, because the second half of It Can Happen Here paralleled so amazingly the same things that we were just predicting, you know, just going, well, what happened if art, it had to be free, it became mandated that art was free, what would happen? And the future was so similar, it was scary.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, those little things mm-hmm. that are, you know, you tweak it a little bit. And that's I think, the success of Black Mirror, that it's now a Netflix show, but it was originated out of England. It's very Twilight Zone-esque. But
oh, okay.
They essentially take a little bit of what we've got going on now in our culture, our technological culture, and they tweak it just a little bit, or they make it like the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
It creates that dystopia where you're like, this is horrible. Mm-hmm. And they're very good at that. Well, but yet, you know, those things, they happen so gradually. That's what I keep coming back to, is this gradual change, this slow change. Then you get these things like, well, you know, we were talking about it earlier too, with the editor loses his job. And people would say, well, the government can't dictate that. Well, maybe not necessarily the government, but a corporation can.
Sure does. And honestly, that's mostly our government these days.
Yeah, where do the lines cross? And, you know, if a corporation is a person now too.
Yes.
So, you know, what exactly are we doing? We're watching cute cat and dog videos, which is fine, but what else are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the line from the picnic. How did this all get going? Oh, we were busy looking at the
view.
We were looking at the view and something happened.
Yeah.
So it can't
happen.
But
also
here.
Too, we become inured to it. When those small steps, is like, it may be an inconvenience, but it's like, okay, well, that's what it is. So it makes the next small step more palatable.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you feel like you have no power and you have no say, then how can I push back? How can I make a difference?
Yeah, good question.
And I think It Can Happen Here helps ask that, where it's like, well, what steps could a Jessup have taken? What steps could the rest of his family have taken? Because his family's nearly devastated by the end. And so how can things be different?
Yeah, it's almost like, how do you stop a rising tide, though?
It's true.
None of them are directly involved. I mean, maybe Jessup is talking about it in the newspaper, but nobody else actually makes a difference, because does it seem like anybody can make a difference?
And I think that's an important question to ask, too, because we can. We've just been brainwashed to think that we can't, that power is not within us anymore. And again, coming into this election as citizens, you have power. Vote.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thanks for dropping in and chatting about this.
Oh, you bet. Thank you.
And that was Carol Cooley here on The Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. As we wrap up our discussion about Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, performed in the Arena Theater at St. Cloud State University as part of a nationwide night of readings of the play. For a chance to listen to the entire play, It Can't Happen Here, as produced by St. Cloud State University, you can find a link to it on our website at kvsc.org under the Podcasts and Untold Stories of Central Minnesota tab. It'll be a little further down the page from this story, or you can link to it from this story. And that's where you'll also be able to find links to the Berkeley Repertory Theater's website with all the information on the National Night of Readings of It Can't Happen Here. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and I'm reminding you to vote after you do some honest research. And The Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible through support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and has been produced at KVSC, proud member of AMPRS.
Divers Radio for Minnesota's communities.